My name is Dick Costolo. I'm delighted to be moderating this event today. And by way of introducing the senator, I thought I would just read from a back flap of her wonderful book, Plenty Ladylike, because it's a great bio. In 2006, Claire McCaskill was the first woman from Missouri elected as a United States Senator and continues to serve in that position today. She has a BA and a JD from the University of Missouri and worked for the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office before she was elected to her first state legislature position in the Missouri House in 1982. She lives in St. Louis with her husband and blended family of 7 children and 9 grandchildren. Senator, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for being here.
Okay, so we'll jump right in. I thought I would start off with the very beginning of the book. You and throughout, you talk about your mom quite a bit, and she was the third ward. She won the third ward seat in the Columbia City Council. You're in high school when she has this moment where you're in the audience, and you say the night she was sworn in was so embarrassing. And then you go on to talk about the kinds of things she did and some of her antics, and it seemed to inform some of your boldness. Could you just talk about that a little bit and what some of those things were?
You know, at the time, it was incredibly embarrassing. But here's what she did. We're sitting in the audience, and this was Columbia, Missouri, which is the School of Journalism. So there's about 7 journalists for every city council member at this event, and lots of photographers because everybody's in school learning how to be a photographer. Mom goes up with a brown paper bag to the front, and this has been historically a good old boys city council, the businessmen in town, the Chamber of Commerce. So the fact that Mom had gotten elected was a little earth-shattering in Columbia. She comes with this brown paper bag. She opens the brown paper bag. She slowly takes out a picture of her children and puts it at her seat. Then she takes out a vase of flowers, and I'm like this. And then she takes out an apron and ties on the apron and then proceeds to sit down to take her place at the city council. Now, I was very embarrassed and mortified. All of us were that were part of her family, not my dad, but he was kind of used to it. But we were really embarrassed. But looking back, it was an incredible role modeling moment for me, because what she was really doing was saying in a powerful visual way, I'm not afraid, I'm different, I'm going to be bold. And she did it in a way that was compelling. So while at the time I just said, Mom, please stop, to almost everything she did in public, later in life I realized that it was in fact her that gave me the ability to kind of be aggressive when maybe others might have shied away from controversy.
You go on to talk about her making you proud and nervous, and that's sort of that same
manner. It was a mix of, you know, what would she do? At one point at a council meeting, she got off the dais and went into the audience to heckle. Yeah. I mean, really? She was something else. My mom was something else.
So you're moving forward. You're in the Missouri General Assembly, and there was a great discussion in the book. Actually, it was fascinating to me about sexism, not just from men, but also from other women. You talked about Winnie Weber and the Kit Bond moment, and Bob Griffin and his almost remarkable knee pads comment. Are we beyond that now? I mean, I know it's only 20, 25, 30 years later, but if we're not beyond that, how much of a problem is it still for both men and women?
Well, I think it's still a problem. When this book was being printed, I talk about in this book, as you referenced, that the Speaker of the House, when I was a freshman legislator, when I asked him how I could get my bill out of committee, he asked me if I'd brought my knee pads. I was certainly harassed as a young intern back in the 70s, and so it was depressing to me when this book was actually being printed, and I tell all these stories in the book, that there was a scandal that broke out in Missouri with a couple of high-powered Missouri legislators getting caught in a sexually propositioning interns. And one of the things that I do in this book that I hope the readers appreciate is that I tell a lot of stuff that you're not supposed to talk about if you do what I do for a living. And one of the things I admit a lot is that I'm not sure I did things right. And I didn't confront this in a public way when I had this happen to me. I worked around it. I figured out how to strategically work around it. It fueled me. It made me mad that I was being minimalized, but I used that as just energy to show these jerks that I was better at this than they were and I was going to be better than they are. So imagine how depressing it is that as this book is going to print, the same stuff's going on 40 years later. The difference is these young women confronted it publicly, and both these jerks lost their careers over it. So that one of the young women reached out to me and called me and was very kind and said, listen, you know, you've been such a role model and all that. And I said, listen, you're the one. You're the one with courage. I never confronted it publicly. You did. And probably what you've done is a much bigger deterrent to that kind of behavior going forward than anything I have done. So, and I will say there is, it's somewhat better. Even though that happened in Missouri just in the last 6 months, I will tell you there is not a marginalization of women in the United States Senate. Now, part of it is they were a lot older, but part of it is that if you get to the United States Senate, you know, our colleagues know that we're all pretty tough cookies. A woman who gets the United States Senate, you know, you just probably don't want to mess around with her too much because she's figured out some stuff. So the 20 of us, we love to do this because it drives them crazy. The 20 of us will kind of gather on the floor of the Senate. And when we do that, it scares the men to death because they're like, oh, my Lord, they're all together. They're formidable. What are we going to do? So I will say that I've never felt marginalized or disrespected as a woman in the United States Senate, where I have been certainly felt that way in other jobs I've had.
And just to segue directly from that and skip forward a little bit, can you talk about Emily's List a bit and your involvement with that and how that's helped?
Well, I particularly talk about in the book how frustrating it's been for me. Listen, I think Citizens United is the most corrosive thing that has happened in our democracy in its history. But having said that, I am one of the reasons I am in the United States Senate is I learned to ask people for money. I was raised that it was impolite to talk about money. So imagine my surprise, I found myself in a career where I was calling perfect strangers and asking them for checks with commas in it. It is a bizarre deal, raising money for politics. So Emily's List has done something amazing in this country because they have motivated women to give money. And, of course, many of you may not know what Emily's List stands for. You think there was an Emily somewhere. But it stands for Early Money is Like Yeast. And the idea is that if you can get contributions either earlier in your campaign cycle or earlier you're in your career, then that is an investment that it's smart for women to make in other women. And it has been a tremendous help to me. In fact, they're having their annual lunch here in San Francisco on Friday, and I'm honored to be the keynote speaker there to thank them all for all the help they've given across the years. Women are really not very good at making political contributions. Wealthy women
and why
are terrible
that?
At it. I mean, this is my theory. And, you know, somebody here is probably smarter than I am and will say I'm wrong, and they may be absolutely correct. But my theory is that women have a tendency to see money as security. I think men have a tendency to see money as power.
Right.
So if it's security, you're thinking, well, writing a $100 check to a city council candidate, how does that get me anything? And on the other hand, if you're a man in business and you want to be able to call somebody on the city council to get information, or you think this is somebody who, you know, writing $100, you don't think about it. So women, I have a thing I do with women, and it's really fun because I get these checks with this on the memo line. I do this little shtick with women. There's a blouse that you saw somewhere.
Blouse in the closet.
And it was on sale. And it was, you thought, I got to have it. It's on sale. It's great. You didn't take time to try it on. You got it home and it gapped right here. I don't know what they do about designing blouses. I mean, you can be like a stick and they still gap. But it gaps, or it's the wrong color. It didn't fit right. It pulled, and it sat in your closet for years and you never, and finally you put it in a garage sale or you gave it away. Write a check for the amount of that blouse. Maybe it's 1999, maybe it's 199. Write a check from out of that blouse to any candidate you believe in. And I said, if you write it to me, be sure and put blouse on the memo line. And to this day, I get checks with blouse on the memo line, which is great fun for me.
I love that story in the book. I want to talk about campaigns a little bit. In your, you know, at the very beginning and the very end of the book, talk about in 1982 when you're going door to door and you get the door slammed in your face. And you even mentioned at the very end of the book, you know, you sort of inspire people to find your own slammed door that's going to push you forward to achieve. You've got the re-election to the House for the third time, then the governor's race in 2004, and then these Senate campaigns, and there are all these ups and downs. Just, can you talk about what that's like to go through? I think that people, and I'll tell you, the reason I ask is I think people have an idea that, you know, people who are successful in politics kind of have this steady march from this office to the next one higher up, to the Senate, to and so forth. But in the book, it's very clear it's filled with ups and downs. And you even mention running against Addie Winslow for the House for the third time and having a nightmare that you're standing at your desk in the Missouri House and your friend comes up to you and says, what are you doing here? You lost.
Right.
And so talk about what that's like. I mean, even going from the 2004 governor's campaign to then there you are on stage at the in a primetime slot at the Democratic National Convention in 2008, endorsing Obama. What are those highs and lows like? And I think it's very, very different than probably what most other people go through on a year-to-year basis with their own careers.
Well, it's interesting because I think it is more roller coaster-like in politics. And part of that is you're putting yourself out for public acceptance or rejection. Mm. You may not get that promotion at work, or you may be disappointed right. that you don't get that job, but it's generally not blared across right. the front page of the paper. Right. And, you know, when somebody in your family screws up, it's painful, but generally you don't have TV cameras parked out in your front yard like I have had in my career when I was the elected DA in Kansas City and my then husband got caught smoking pot on a gambling boat. Not a good moment.
Oh, it's going to be my next question.
Yeah, well, we can get to that. But there is this up and down. And but that's kind of where the resiliency comes from. I had, from the time I was about 12 years old, made up my mind I was going to be the first woman governor of Missouri. And I ran against an incumbent governor of my own party in 2004. Did the unheard of, not only taking on my own party, but the governor. And nobody had ever done that successfully in Missouri. In fact, it's only been done a handful of times in the country. And I beat him in the primary. And then I went on to lose narrowly in November. So I laid on the couch for about 3 months and baked probably 100 dozen chocolate chip cookies and consumed most of those myself. I was very depressed. My husband, my second husband, who I'm grateful to have as my life partner now and forever, he's the one who kind of grabbed me and said, get up, you got to get back at this. And then Schumer and Harry Reid started calling, trying to talk me into running against an incumbent U.S. senator. And I'm going, wait a minute, let me see if I get this straight. I just couldn't win this race for an open seat as governor, and you think I can take on in a non-presidential cycle in Missouri a Republican incumbent senator and win? But they talked me into it, and I ran and won. And I hope this book shows young women and young men how that thing that people who love you say, when one door shuts, another door opens, blah, 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 blah. I never paid much attention to it, but as it turned out, that was really true for me. I wouldn't have ever won the Senate race had I not failed at the governor's race. But it is, you've got to get a really tough skin if you're in politics. I mean, I opened up my Twitter account. Thanks, by the way, for this. The trolling that goes on my Twitter feed, I think, frankly, is probably, you know, they read mean tweets. I mean, every day I could do a whole show. You know, your face is like a diaper, you old hag. You're too ugly for me to look at. You corrupt piece of... I mean, it is amazing how mean people are. But you just have to kind of realize you can't make everybody happy if you get anything done.
My mentions on Twitter have similar similar commentary with some.
We should do a drawdown on mean tweets, yeah. Dick.
Okay, it's a good idea. I'm gonna. There are a bunch of really great questions here, so I'm gonna start going to some of the questions from the audience, and then I'll hop back and forth between these and mine. What do you think of the current success of some of the outsider politics folks like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders? Is this a new era of politics in America?
It really isn't. If you look at history, there has always been this wonderful eternal optimist in America that if we just get somebody who's more of an outsider, we can change things overnight. But our founding fathers created a system of governance that is very interdependent. A new president can't get much done without Congress that is willing to work with them, and vice versa. And just because somebody's from the outside doesn't mean that they have any of the skill sets that are needed to navigate that government that is, at its essence, a check and balance form of government. And the American people in their wisdom sent one party to the presidency and another party to Congress, and then everybody wants to complain that we don't get anything done. Well, duh. I mean, we're not going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, I don't agree with much that they think is important in this country. And by the way, neither does the president. So how can we make things happen? How can we really move things forward? And so in that moment of frustration over a divided government, I think a lot of people just think, well, let's just take the status quo and shake it real hard. And then somehow, magically, everybody will get along and it'll be unicorns and rainbows and government will work well and there'll be income equality and according to Donald Trump, we will have a different kind of country because we will no longer respect immigrants in this country or women or, well, it's a long list with Donald, isn't it? I don't have time for all the things that Donald doesn't respect. So I respect the sentiment of the voters that are going there, but because I get it. I understand it. But I just want to remind everybody here, and you really need to think about this. I'm from a swing state. I tease Barbara and Diane when they talk to me about what I'm going to vote for. I go, really? Come with me to Shannon County. You know, I mean, they think conservative. I mean, their most conservative county is like, you know, lefty for Missouri. So it is nobody calls me and asks me to compromise. No one ever writes and says compromise. Now, a whole bunch of people in America and in my state say, why don't you get anything done? But all the noise in the system is being generated by rigid ideology, people who want us to be purists. Those are the people who are advocating. Those are the people who are writing. And by the way, that's the way we consume media now. We don't go for information. We go for affirmation. It's a long way from Huntley and Brinkley, folks. We are a long way from Walter Cronkite. We are now in the land of Ed Schultz and Sean Hannity, which is a long way from straight down the middle factual news. So I really think that to all those people who are drawn to an outsider candidate, you need to be more patient with folks who are willing to compromise and less patient with folks who say it has to be pure and all my way.
I have sort of two sides of a topic here. Again, early on in the book, you talk about being a prosecutor in Jackson County. And victims' rights and some of the work you did there on victims' rights. A couple things. One, what did that teach you? You talk about witnessing some, I can imagine, some particularly horrible things involving children, for example. How did that affect the way you think about things like victims' rights? And then adding on to that, this question from the audience, is there any possibility that someone in Washington would read the first part of the Second Amendment and have the courage to do something about gun control? Just taking that all together and thinking about that topic.
Well, pardon the bad pun, but that's a loaded question. I have seen firsthand the horrific violence that occurs in our country because of our love affair with guns. And I can tell you lots of stories about people who thought they were prepared to defend themselves, but because they were being confronted by someone who didn't respect human life, they ended up dead. This notion that if we're all armed, that we're somehow going to be safer, It doesn't work that way in the real world. It just doesn't. I had an FBI agent when I was in Kansas City that got robbed in a parking garage with a stick wrapped in a Taco Bell bag. You know, he stuck it in his ribs and said, "Give me your wallet." And of course, the FBI agent, highly trained and had a weapon, immediately turned to draw down on the would-be robber. And guess who ended up shot? It wasn't the guy with the Taco Bell bag. It was the FBI agent. And that's just one example I can give you of many where guns don't make us safer. The reality is the gun folks in this country are in charge politically. They're in charge politically. I've had the NRA try to beat me every time I've run. They spend a lot of money. I have survived. But I've also had to continue to reinforce that I have no problem with the hunting culture in my state, because my dad was a big hunter. I grew up around him hunting, and that has kind of helped take that edge off when the NRA comes after me, because most people in my state, I mean, believe that the Second Amendment is the ability of anybody to own a gun of any kind anywhere. So I don't know how. Now, most Americans want us to have more gun regulation around gun purchases, better background checks, gun show loophole. And I think that the Democratic nominee will campaign on that, and I think the Democratic nominee will get votes on that. So I do think we have a chance of actually doing some reform. We came within two votes in the Senate of passing reform around this issue. We lost by two. Now, since that time, the Republicans have more people in the Senate because they won last time. But I think we've got a good chance of taking the Senate next year, and I think we'll be back to within a really close margin of doing something on background checks.
Great. As a senator, you've certainly made a name for yourself going after waste, and you talk about that a bit in the book. The Arlington National Cemetery scandal is particularly one of those. You know, I read that passage and thought, you know, if you saw it in a movie, you wouldn't believe it. And you even mentioned in part of that, one of the paragraphs, you say sort of every document I would look at had me saying, you know, you've got to be kidding me. What are the things that are going on in Washington now that, you know, we don't hear about, that if we knew about them, we would think ourselves, you've got to be kidding me?
I got a good one. Are you ready for this? They have the hack at OPM where all of the federal government employees' records were accessed. So they are in a panic mode, and government is bad at contracting, particularly in a panic mode, which means any time in war or in a moment where they think they have to do something quickly, and it gives them an excuse to not follow all the rules of contracting. And so they did a no-bid contract. Now hold on to your hat as to who they contracted with. There's a contractor who I caught that was providing security for our embassy in Kabul. And I don't know if you remember this news story with all the drunken guards that were out in the back around the bonfire, all painted up, and there was all this sexually suggestive stuff. They were supposed to be guarding the embassy, and they were all drunk and in paints. And I mean, it looked like a fraternity party. That company changed its name and right now is under investigation for $135 million in improper payments they received, and they got the no-bid contract to fix the hack at OPM. Can't make it up. You can't make it up. I called them and I said, are you kidding me? This is the company you give a multi-year contract to that has this history of underperforming, non-performing, bad performing, and is under investigation right now? But that's just one. I could sit here. I could, you know, and that's what I was saying to Dick was, we were talking about this before we came in here. What's frustrating to me about the new pressure that journalism is under in terms of having a business model that works is that we've all gotten so used to quick consumption, the clicks and the eyeballs, and we move around quickly. And we're, you know, I mean, I have a member of my family that only gets news through Twitter feed. It's the only place that she reads all the news. So nobody is out there pulling the thread and doing the story of substance that would get Americans riled up. You know, it's easier just to talk about Donald Trump or to talk about the emails or to talk about Kim Kardashian or to talk about Caitlyn or to talk about something that gets people's interest quickly. And the sad thing is that there's so many things that the journalists could be doing that would help make our government better, because it's just as sensational, some of this stuff. I mean, if you want to make somebody mad or you want to make somebody afraid, which is what drives traffic, a lot of these stories will do that if they would just take the time to dig in and find them. But journalists now are not given that time to do that. And it's a real problem going forward in terms of the accountability of our government.
And so given that, how intractable is the waste and abuse? You tell that story you just told, and it makes one think, well, I mean, it's borderline ridiculous. Is it fixable?
Well, some of it is. We've done some real good work. I won't say that we're there yet, but we went in and just guns a-blazing went after the contracting issues in Iraq. And we now have special inspector generals that are required in contingencies because of the work we did. Jim Webb, who is no longer a senator, but who is a good buddy of mine, he and I worked together on the War Contracting Commission that came out with a bunch of recommendations. And then the commission went away, like they should, and we in fact enacted most of those recommendations in the law. So now there must be a special inspector general for every contingency looking over the shoulder of the military and how they contract. And this is one of my favorite stories. You want to know if I ever feel like I'm getting anything done? If you ever want to know why do you keep doing this and why do you still get impassioned and feel great about my work, there was a man that worked in the Capitol that took a civil assignment over in Afghanistan. And he went over and spent 18 months helping with some issues over there that was his expertise. I think it was agriculture. And he came back, and he called my staff, and he says, I got to tell you this story because the senator will get a big kick out of it. He said, I was sitting in a room in a building outside of Kabul, and they were discussing they needed to buy this stuff. And somebody in the room said, well, I think we can get away with doing it on a no-bid contract. And the commander in the room said, no, if we do that, McCaskill will be all over it. So I'm going, yes, all the way in Afghanistan, victory.
Victory. Well, yeah, well done. There are a number of questions with a similar theme here, and so I'll sort of combine them all. Senator McCaskill, have you ever and would you ever consider a run for the presidency? Rachel Maddow has called you the Democrats' best alternative to Hillary Clinton. So irrespective of whether it's this time or next time or what have you, what are your thoughts on that?
I just don't think I'm that crazy. It's really, I mean, one of the blessings of being close to a presidential campaign, which I had the incredible opportunity to be in 2008. And I look forward to hopefully being in that kind of role in 2016 for Hillary Clinton. But is you get to see what it's like up close, the process of running. And I'm close enough friends with the president that I have a chance to visit with him privately from time to time and get a sense of what it really feels like when you're there and how it works. And I just don't think I'm well suited for it. I don't think I would have the patience. I think I would lose it, you know. I think I just want to kill somebody. So I'm really happy where I am. I got a lot of work to do in the Senate. We got a lot more women to elect to the Senate, and I've got to stick around there for a while.
I want to go back to talking about the media for a minute. We just had that conversation about the sort of BuzzFeedification of the media today. But also in the book, you talk about the fact that and the media, in some cases, reinforces stereotypes about women in politics and so forth. For example, you mention and refer to the Associated Press focusing on Wendy Davis's pink tennis shoes during her filibuster in the Texas Capitol, and when would, what is the likelihood that they would have talked about what kind of shoes a man was wearing? How much does that media narrative or does that sort of bias, intentional or unintentional, in the media play into some of the issues that women have in politics or in professional roles in general?
Most of it's just irritating. You know, when we have our dinners, we just, you know, kind of complain about it and kvetch about it. But some of it is insidious. And I'll tell you the one example that I relate to personally because of the pain it has caused me, and that is the double standard when it comes to spouses of candidates. Hmm. You know, both John Kerry and John McCain had spouses that had very complicated financial wealth. They had lots of money and lots of tentacles and I'm sure lots of trusts and lots of business interests, lots of investments, and I don't ever recall them being trashed or dragged through the mud about various business decisions they might have made, or how they were avoiding taxes, and or how they were using the tax code. But you find a woman, I mean, if you're a woman senator and you're not married to a librarian, buckle up. Buckle up, because it's coming. It's coming. They go out, they've gone after both my first husband when I was married to him, and I mean, they've just been relentless with my second husband. It has been terribly, I mean, I'm fine because I'm tough and I'm used to it, but this was new to him. And he was shocked. You know, he was shocked what they were doing to him. I mean, here's a guy who his first job out of school was in a steel mill. He self-made, created thousands of jobs, great wealth. I mean, he's a frickin' poster for the Republican Party, right? He's what they love to talk about. But because he's married to me, he's a tax-cheating SOB. And these ads they did, they were all about, you know, his failure to take care of people in his facilities, or his tax stuff that he did. And it was just awful and terribly unfair. So that's some place where there's an incredible double standard. I know Diane has had some of those issues in her career also with Dick. So I tease Amy Klobuchar that the most strategic thing she ever did was marry a professor.
Just sticking with this topic a bit, I mean, it's a central theme of the book, Redefining Ladylike. There was a 2010 study that you referenced in the book mentioning that calling female candidates sexist names actually significantly reduces their political standing in people's minds. Senator Murkowski's opponent refers to her in a recent recently, as a member of the world's oldest profession. Senator Landrieu is referred to as a high-class prostitute on a television program. Talk about what needs to happen. How do we get past that? This has obviously been an ongoing problem for some time. You mentioned that it's getting a little bit better. What needs to happen, and how do women need to think about that when they're pursuing careers like this?
Well, I will say that it continues to be a problem, but the good news is that there is now almost a visceral reaction in the electorate when it goes too far. I mean, I think you might remember that happened with legitimate rape.
Legitimate rape, yeah.
Where a man equated your ability to get pregnant with whether or not intercourse was consensual, or as I called it in the book, the chapter called The Magic Uterus. You know, when that happened, I mean, at some point in time, that really motivated women. I mean, our campaign just lit up at that moment. Women from all over the country, all over the world, were wanting to help. And I think these guys are very perilously close. When I saw Marco Rubio say in the debate that he did not favor a rape and incest exception to abortion restrictions, I went, what? I mean, that's like, there's never been a Republican candidate for president in the history of our country that didn't support a rape and incest exception, ever. So I think there is this line that you can do this stuff, but if you go too far, you create the kind of energy that carries campaigns across the finish line.
Mm-hmm. Great. I have a couple foreign policy questions from the audience.
Let me guess
what one of them is.
Let me guess.
I'll start with the other one.
Okay.
Yeah. As the U.S. opens relations with Cuba, how do you think our government should address their human rights issues with regard to the Cuban people, et cetera?
I think we have to do the same thing with Cuba that we do with many other countries that we have relations with. I mean, obviously, we do. We have relations with many countries that have practices that we find abhorrent. But not having relations with them is more damaging to the Cuban people. Because what Castro has done, and I didn't realize this fully until I went down there, the Castro family has used our unwillingness to recognize them as their excuse to the Cuban people. It's the imperialist embargo that is making us not prosperous. And by the way, you understand that every other country in the world recognizes Cuba. We're it. I mean, Canada, Great Britain, France, Germany, all of our friends, we're it. And so it really has just been a fig leaf mm-hmm. for the Castros. So the sooner we remove that fig leaf and the sooner that all the Cuban people realize that that's just been his excuse all this time, I think the better off that the Cuban people will be, because it will give them, and you see the green shoots of entrepreneurship down there. And by the way, they love us, the Cuban people. They are so excited. This is a huge deal to the Cuban people. And I think that they're going to have more ability to stand up to the human rights abuses with this excuse removed from the Castro repertoire.
Okay, and then the second one, it's coming from someone from Missouri. I'm from Festus. My granddaughter goes to WashU, as did my whole family. And the question is, as you can guess, about Iran. What are your thoughts?
Well, first, it's a remarkable thing that somebody from Festus ended up in San Francisco. Just saying. Just saying. If you understood where Festus was, you would understand Festus is in Jefferson County, and it's kind of a conservative place. Here's where I am on the Iran deal. I have tried to spend the last couple of weeks. I was really irritated. The Republicans wanted 60 days to look at this deal, and it appeared to me they all made up their mind in 5 minutes. I thought it was pretty important. I'm not voting for or against this deal. I'm voting either for this deal or for a new status quo. So my decision is, which is better for Israel and for our national security, the deal or the new status quo? So I spent my time trying to figure out what the new status quo is. Will we be able to hold on to all the sanctions? Will the sanctions regime remain as robust as it has over the last several years, which has isolated Iran and brought them to the table? Because if we can't isolate them and keep them at the table, we couldn't get a better deal. If China starts doing business with them, if Russia starts doing business with them, and by the way, we don't even have their money. Everybody says we're going to give them $60 billion. Well, I wanted to figure out, are they going to get the $60 billion anyway? Because the countries that hold their money are South Korea, Japan, China, India, and Turkey. So I've spent my time talking to those five countries, trying to get a straight answer, which, by the way, if you haven't tried to get a straight answer out of the ambassador from China, you really haven't lived. I mean, this is somebody who is schooled in how to never give a straight answer.
When I was over there, I would always get, "We have an old saying in China," and that would be, and I was with a Chinese person from Shanghai who would look at me and go, "That's not an old saying."
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out, will they get this money anyway if we don't do the deal? Will they end up without cement down their centrifuges with billions of dollars that they can funnel to Hezbollah and other groups? So I'm almost finished with that process. I should make an announcement with today or tomorrow, and I would give you a preview, but he'd kill me. Like that guy from my office that doesn't want me to, he wants me to put it out when I put it out. But I will just tell you, I think you can probably tell from my conversation with you now that I am very worried that the new status quo would isolate Israel much more than it is now, which is dangerous for the Israelis, and it would certainly isolate America in terms of its ability to be the stimulus for diplomatic answers to difficult world problems.
Coming back to the book, toward the end of the book, you talk about there's some discussion about balance, and you mention, in fact, your quote is, "There is guilt. No matter how hard you try to find balance, there's guilt about not having it." Do you worry, or do you think that there's maybe too much a focus on, you have to have balance in your life, and that's not really always possible when you're doing everything you need to do? How do you think about that?
I don't really give much thought to how balanced I am. I gave a lot of thought to how good a mom I was when my kids were young. That's where the guilt really came in. Because my mom, while she was very busy and worked outside the home in a number of civic endeavors, she didn't have the kind of career I had, which required me to be away from my children at moments that were gut-wrenching. Like, I missed my youngest daughter's last on-point performance as a dancer. I mean, how do you ever really get over that, right? I mean, it's like this sigh in the audience of all the women going, "Oh, my God, that's terrible." But it is. It is. Now, having said that, it is so much better now because my children are grown. And they're amazing human beings. They're independent. They're smart. They're stable. They're grounded. They talk back to me with authority and information. And I'm not sure that if I had been more of a helicopter mom, they'd be that way. They had to figure some stuff out for themselves because I wasn't always in the moment with them. On the other hand, I worked hard to have those moments. And I talk about in the book, I went back to the kids as I was writing this book and said, now I want you to be honest with me. Tell me horrible moments that you had because I wasn't there. You know, I really want you to be honest with me. And, you know, they kind of struggled, and maybe they were just being nice, but Lily was really funny. She said, well, Mom, there was one thing. At lunch, and I put this in the book because I thought it was funny, she said, I'd look around and everybody had homemade sandwiches, but I always had Lunchables. And I'm like going, oh, my God, Lily, I'm so sorry. You know, I mean, she goes, no, it was cool. Everybody wanted to trade for my Lunchables. So she may have just been trying to make me feel better. But it goes under that category of you can't sweat the small stuff. You know, like I say in the book, dust bunnies under the bed, to hell with them. You know, my kids' clothes not all being pressed, forget about it. You know, you just prioritize naturally. And I really am worried about young women today. And that's why I hope a lot of fathers buy this book for their daughters, because my dad gave me permission, along with my mom, but my dad was great about giving me permission to not be attractive to men in high school and college because I was so loud and bossy and opinionated. And I really want young women today to feel more comfortable with navigating the guilt of motherhood and career. You can do it, and you can do it well. And I worry that there seems to be a little backsliding, that women are thinking, well, if I don't have to work, I shouldn't. And it's not that they should, but they sure ought to look at it as an option that's viable instead of assuming that somehow it means they're not going to have a strong family and wonderful children and really enjoy motherhood. So I'm hoping this book helps speak to some of those young women.
That's great. Thank you. In the same, sort of in the same paragraph there, you say something that really jumped off the page at me. You just referenced a bit when you talked about your parents. You say, don't be afraid to offend. Talk about that.
Well, most women have a disease to appease. And what that means is we want everyone to get along. We want everyone to be happy. We want everyone to like us. We want to be the conciliator, whether it's bringing our neighbors together or bringing our children together. I think most women are uncomfortable doing things that they know are going to make people mad or offend people. And I was, you know, once again, my family, when I was young, I was very beside myself because I was trying to get this organization I belonged to have some diversity. And I had a real blowback from my friends about it. And I was, you know, really upset about it. My dad said, hey, you know, you don't have to be a leader. Don't be a leader. And then you'll never make anybody mad. But if you're going to be a leader, you're going to infuriate people. And you just got to get comfortable with that everybody's not going to be happy. And so this whole notion that you can go along in life and never rock the boat and keep everybody happy, I mean, that's like permanently wearing a pair of shoes that's two sizes too small. I mean, it's incredibly painful and limiting. And so it's very freeing, by the way. And by the way, I've got it down. I mean, about a third of my state thinks I'm Satan on a horse. So I am totally down with offending people because I offend people all the time that disagree with me in my state.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I used to always tell my managers, managing by trying to be liked is the path to ruin.
That's right.
Okay, so this great question from the audience. Your reforms regarding campus sexual assault have been a catalyst for a very positive change. How can Congress protect universities from backlash from perpetrators who are suing schools and other sorts of backlash?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, I hate people when afraid of loss or who are so afraid of lawsuits. You know, I think you do the right thing. And if you do the right thing, I mean, I'm somebody, you probably don't know very many people. They say they're litigators now. I hope I'm not offending anybody in the room that calls themselves a litigator, but most people who are lawyers who call themselves litigators now, they shuffle a lot of paper, but they never get up in front of a jury. If more people would try cases to juries, our country would be so much better off, because juries are pretty smart at figuring out what the real deal is. If a university does the right thing in terms of the way of setting up their processes, making sure the process, people that are doing the Title IX adjudications are trained, making sure that everybody has notice, and our bill requires that, that not just does the alleged victim have notice and transparency, so does the alleged perpetrator have notice and transparency. And whatever the victim has in terms of assistance, so does the alleged perpetrator. So I think we've done a pretty good job in the legislation balancing that. But this notion that I've heard from several universities that they are very afraid of being sued, do the right thing, do it professionally, do it with a system that makes sense, review your processes, make sure they work, and it'll all turn out fine. And ultimately, to use the fear of being sued as an excuse to not do everything you can to make students safe on your campus, I think is perilously close to a cop-out.
We've talked about the sort of extreme views in media now, and gone are the days of the Huntley-Brinkley report. What has happened to the moderates in Congress itself? You know, there are very few people like yourself who are both, you know, very strong on victims' rights and yet also doing some of these other other things we're talking about. Where are all the moderates?
Well, they're mostly from states like mine that are not red or blue, that can go back and forth. And if you look through the Midwest, there's a bunch of them. You know, you got Ohio. Look at all the states where there's one Democrat and one Republican. And most of the time, you'll find the majority of the moderates from those states. So what's the problem? If we have some of them, why can't we get more people to the middle? Well, it's really the House. So you need to understand that it wasn't that long ago that there were probably, 100 swing districts in the House. I see my friend Mike Muir here. He could probably tell me right off the top of his head because he's a data machine. But there were certainly dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of House swing districts. They have now perfected the art of redistricting to keep everybody safe. So if you're safe, what are you worried about? You're worried about a primary. So if you're a Democrat in a safe Democratic district, you're worried about your left flank. If you're a Republican in a safe Republican district, what are you worried about? You're worried about your right flank. You've got no motivation to come to the middle.
And now, do open primaries, is that an answer to this, to the...
Well, what do you guys, do you think it's helped in California, open?
Yeah,
I would like to see us do more of what you guys have done here. You know, you're a blue enough state that it typically makes it a little awkward when you end up with two Democrats in the final election. I mean, it makes it painful for all of you who have friends that are running against each other at the end. But on the other hand, if you had swing districts, more swing districts, but that's the thing, it still matters about the district. Because if the district is bright red, the top two contenders are going to be red, and if the district is bright blue, the top two contenders are going to be blue, right? So it really is about citizens taking back redistricting and trying to help draw districts in a way that are more reflective of the reality of the geography or the socioeconomics of that area, so that you could get some districts that conceivably... And the other thing that's happened is there's just... It's very hard to be a moderate in the Republican Party right now. I mean, if we talk about the Todd Akin race, what was astounding was it was the first time I'd ever had a close look at Republican primary polling data. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just shocking. And I talk about this in the book. I mean, the majority of the Republicans that were voting in the primary in Missouri love the fact that my Todd Akin said that Barack Obama was a menace to society. And the majority of them didn't think Obama was born in America. You know, I mean, the majority of them certainly didn't believe in climate change. So, you know, it is really that cleaving to this right that has gone on. I mean, look at these candidates, how far to the right they're driving in order to win a Republican primary. Now, eventually, they're going to fall off the earth, and they won't be able to win anything. And I do think they're perilously close to that now. They're getting so far to the right.
again, hopping back to some of the themes in the book, if you could give just, this is also a question from the audience, if you could give just one piece of advice to a young woman for how she could prepare for a career of service through politics, what would it be?
Well, I would say that she needs to focus on what she wants to do and drive towards it. If she wants to be in Congress, she needs to start thinking immediately, okay, where's the district I would run? What does it look like? Who do I know there? What campaign can I work on in that area right now? I started working on campaigns when I was in high school. I worked on campaigns all through college. I made my selection, this is bad, I know, but I'm, you know, this is tell-all. I made my selection for law school based on the fact that if I went in Missouri, everybody I went to law school with would be contributors of mine when I ran for office. Because if I went to Georgetown or I went to Emory, I mean, I'd never get all those guys to come and help me in Missouri when I ran for office, but at Missouri Law School, they'd all be in the state, right? So thinking that way, I think women, I mean, that's what people said, well, why did you tell those stories about what you did in the Aiken campaign, and why would you do that? Because I want women to own being strategic, to really navigating and looking around the corner and figuring out what's the next step and how do I get there. It doesn't just happen to you. Nobody's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, it's your turn. You've got to work for it and figure it out and strategize it. So I would say, you know, do you want to be president? Well, if you want to be president, then it's probably a good idea to get elected governor or senator. And then you start need to think in your mind, how old am I? What year would that election be? What should my resume look like? You think it was an accident that I was in the prosecutor's office instead of the public defender's office? I mean, you know, obviously being a prosecutor helps a woman have credibility a lot more than being a public defender, at least in my state. So, you know, and besides that, I loved being a prosecutor, but, that's the kind of things I tell young women. Don't be afraid to be boldly strategic about how you get there and to own what you want now, not wait. And well, do you think I could someday? Well, of course you can. Yes, of course you can.
We've talked a little bit about, women in the Senate and, what it's like when the 20 of you get together. A question from the audience about the House. Are women marginalized in the House?
That's a good question. I'm not in a good place to answer that. I certainly know that they have, because the Republicans are in charge, they weren't marginalized when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House. I guarantee you that. but now it's hard for me to tell. I don't think they have any women chairmen in the House now. Maybe I think the House Administration Committee, which is a little bit like a signing office space, which... You know, really? I'm not really in a good position to speak to that because I'm not hanging out over there.
So few people giving such a large percentage of campaign funding in these days, this day and age. Do you see voter participation getting even lower? Was people just sort of throw in the towel and worry about, people are just buying these elections anyways? And has anyone considered mandatory voting from the audience?
Well, I think mandatory voting is, you know, what are we going to do, put people in jail, fine them? I don't think that is realistic.
Talk about financing, campaign
financing.
Yeah,
I mean,
presidential elections are almost, you know,
all these candidates are shopping for billionaires now. If you look, I think the numbers that came out, I think it was like around $276 million raised so far for the super PACs of Republican candidates. The candidates all told together, all 752 of them, had raised $78 million. And of the $276 million, almost half of that was given by 67 people. So it gives you some sense of this concentration of power in the super PAC system among the very, very wealthy. Very dangerous, disgusting, and depressing for our country. If people figured it out this time, we will have the ability to amend the Constitution to change Citizens United. And I know that Hillary Clinton is campaigning on that. It is wildly popular in our country to do something to fix what Citizens United has brought down upon our country, which is a lot of dark, big money controlling things. It could make people stay home, but it could also motivate people, depending on how this plays out and how effectively the candidates message it. But if I were Hillary Clinton running for president and all of this huge money was there on the other side, I would try to highlight it and try to reignite people that saying, hey, you know, the Koch brothers only have 2 votes. Mm-hmm. They've only got 2 votes. And the people of this country have, you know, obviously many, many votes that they can counteract those 2 votes.
A theme that runs really throughout the book is one of courage. You, when your ex-husband was busted for smoking pot, you didn't get in front of the cameras and say, well, you know, let's wait and see what happens, and et cetera, et cetera. You got up and
I'm standing
said,
by
everyone,
him. I love
yeah,
him.
You got up and said, help.
He's going to get help.
Well, why don't you just tell everyone in the audience what you did say, and then talk about just how you think about the importance or how you talk about courage to young women getting involved in politics today.
You know, it's fascinating to me because politics is one area where there seems to be, and I guess this is true in other areas too, but since I've spent most of my life in this work, I can speak to it, that when something bad happens and you've made a mistake, there is such a natural tendency to go on defensive and to rationalize and obfuscate and somehow say, well, you know, it wasn't really that way or whatever. And I have made this wonderful discovery because my first husband did something incredibly stupid and hurtful to me. And that was, I just told the truth, how I really felt. My advisor said this, that, or the other, and I said, no. I had a radio program that was already booked, an NPR local program that was very popular in Kansas City. I was out of state when this happened. I wasn't anywhere near Missouri, and I flew back home the next morning after, obviously, I got word of what had happened, and I went on the radio program, and so Walt Bodine, the host, said, well, Claire, why don't you tell, you know, this is your chance to tell people what you think of what happened, and I said, it was stupid. It was incredibly hurtful, and I am so damn angry. It's going to take me 6 months to get over the urge to kill him. And it's what I felt, right? I mean, it was just normal human emotion. And all of a sudden, I'm getting flowers in the office, hang in there, and women were sending me stuffed animals. I had a jerk for a husband once, too, you know? And it was like, really, it was unbelievable. So it was like really interesting to me that when this happens, and the same thing happened later in my career when we've discovered that we'd made this incredibly embarrassing error on taxes on a plane that my husband owned. And here my brand was all about fiscal accountability, and it's uncovered that we owed all this money on this airplane for taxes that hadn't been paid. And, you know, I just called a press conference and got on the call and said, here's what happened. I take full responsibility. I'm mortified. It's all being paid back today, and I'm terribly, terribly sorry. And while it was used and they tried to make it, it just never got traction in Missouri. And I think if more people would do that, frankly, if you're going to say anything for Donald Trump, I mean, the guy is saying amazing things and people aren't getting mad. A lot of people are getting mad at him. But, I mean, I think there is this thirst for people to be authentic and to say exactly what they're thinking and to show a little bit of themselves. Now, it's too bad what Trump is actually thinking. But, at least you get the point, right? That he's not filtering as much.
Yeah, I think admitting mistakes, as you mentioned in the book, is an undervalued element of courage.
I do too.
Okay, Ferguson, you've said there need to be major changes in policing around the country. Talk about that, and particularly in the context of something that was obviously right there.
It's really hard for me because I spent so many years working closely with the police, and I know how good so many of them are and how badly they want to serve their communities respectfully and deferentially to the people that they are trying to protect. And then we had the pattern and practices investigation, which showed that there was a systemic mistreatment of African Americans in this community, and I'm sure it's true in many, many communities around the country. And there's 2 or 3 things that are going on here. I saw a real change when we started implementing community policing in the 90s, when we started having police that were assigned to neighborhoods. So the police got to know the people in that neighborhood, and the neighborhood got to know the police. And there was a connection, and there was a building up of trust. And the police knew who the troublemakers were. And by the way, because the community trusted them,
They would tell them who the troublemakers were and help them hold those troublemakers accountable. And it was this wonderful synergy. In fact, I got to the point that I was assigning prosecutors based on communities. So not only would there be a policeman assigned to your community, when the case was prosecuted, you knew the prosecutor. So victims were much more likely to trust that the case wasn't going to get screwed up or they weren't going to be hung out to dry. But with the shrinking of domestic budgets, with the shrinking of federal money for various municipal things, budgets have gotten more and more stressed, and you see less and less money that can do anything other than responding to 911 calls. And when you're just responding to 911 calls all the time, if you're a police officer, you can lose sight of the community because you are out there time after time, and all you're encountering is the worst. You don't ever encounter the best. And so it's understandable that you can begin to switch your viewpoint that, you know, black people are the problem. So we've got to get back to a community policing model, and we've got to do criminal justice reform. 95% of the people in federal penitentiary are nonviolent, and we're spending $7 billion a year to keep them there. That's just dumb. It's just dumb. There are all kinds of ways. I started along with somebody from this area, one of the first drug courts in the country. Drug courts work. They make, I call them taxpayer factories. They make people who are addicted to drugs get a job, get an education, pay taxes, rejoin their families. They quit stealing. They quit getting welfare. And when it's over, you dismiss the charge against them so they don't have a felony hanging around their neck for the rest of their lives. We can do those kinds of courts. I'm not saying let them go. I'm not saying don't hold them accountable. Do it in a way that makes more sense for all of us instead of giving them expensive bed space. Especially, we got a bunch of people in the federal prison that are over 60. You know what the chances are somebody over 60 commits a crime? I mean, the recidivism for people over 60 is like almost zero. So we can figure out ways to do this. And the good news is a bunch of Republicans are interested. The libertarian movement has helped in that regard. You've got people like Ron Johnson and Rand Paul and other Republicans that are all in trying to look at how we can do some massive criminal justice reform that I think will help.
Okay. I've got, there's only 4 minutes left, but I've got one question and then we'll close on a softball, so you can take your time with this one. These are both from the audience. The first is, what are the two or three very best ways for people to keep up to speed with what's happening in Congress? It's a good question. You see, as you mentioned in the media, you get this sort of the Sean Hannity version of what's going on today in Congress. Where can people go to really understand the debate?
Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of The Economist. I think that you get in-depth looks at a lot of issues that are being struggled. I mean, the article may be written about something that we're not particularly legislating on, but eventually it all comes around, right? I certainly would never tell someone just to go to one source. I mean, I try to do Wall Street Journal every day. I try to do New York Times every day. I obviously skim the Missouri papers every day. I, you know, do National Journal some. And of course I'm lucky because I have staff that are feeding me articles all the time that are substantive. But, I mean, just resist the temptation to surf on the surface and to skim the top. Take the time when you hear something like, you know, well, and there's lots of issues like this. I mean, where you, if you just skim at the top, you never really understand that it's much more complicated than that. It's not the way it's being presented. There is another side to the story. And by the way, sure, almost always there's another side to the story.
And are there sources beyond The Economist that you particularly think are interesting and usually get it right? I mean, I know that...
Christian Science Monitor usually gets it right.
Great.
That's another good one. Both of them, I think, are very straightforward. John, what would you say? My communications director's here. In your opinion, who do you think gets it right? New York Times, yeah. They have real. They still have a bunch of real reporters at the New York Times. Yeah. I mean, a bunch.
Yeah, they were.
And they're all over the place.
Right.
So they, you know, like some of them drive me crazy. That's probably why I didn't mention them over and over again, because I get cranky with them sometimes. But
all right, and last one's a softball for you. As a native Missourian and Mizzou journalism grad, I'd like to talk to you about Todd Akin. Is it true that you bet your daughter you would shotgun a beer?
Yeah, really briefly, and this is a good thing. This is a good thing to close with. Mike Muir is here, who is part of my team and who is an incredibly talented person that does all my mail in my campaigns, and he's from San Francisco and my dear friend, and I want to give him a lot of credit for this. We decided that Todd Akin was the best candidate for us to have in the election because he said a lot of things that were crazy, and we knew that we could show him to be so extreme. The others were extreme too, but he had so many things he'd said publicly that were going to be easier to beat him. So we polled in the Republican primary and figured out what was most popular about what Todd had said. And then I paid for the ad. It said, paid for by Claire McCaskill. I approve this message. And the ad said, Todd Akin is too conservative for Missouri. And it listed all the things that the Republican primary voters loved about him. And, of course, my phone started ringing. Well, if you think he's too conservative, he's perfect. And we're going, yes, he is. So I think Mike actually named the ad. We called it A Cup of Tea because he was a Tea Party guy, and it was he was just what the far right wanted, and it worked, and it worked. So, but it was high risk. I spent more money on that ad than Todd Akin had spent in his entire campaign. It was a unconventional, bold, high risk deal, and I was very nervous about it. I was so lucky because my two daughters, one took a leave from her job and the other was home from school. They traveled with me that summer on the campaign. They saw how nervous I was. They realized I was really buggy about this. This could be a disaster if this went wrong. And Maddie said, Mom, if Todd Akin wins the primary, will you shotgun a beer with us? I had no idea what it was. So for those of you, how many of you know what shotgunning a beer is? Okay. For those of you who don't know, here's what it is. You take a beer and you put a hole in the bottom of the can and you put that over your mouth and you pop the tab and the beer rushes into your mouth. So you've learned something at the Commonwealth Club you didn't think you were going to learn today. So he won the primary that night. And then, of course, he went on to exceed our expectations when he said legitimate rape a few weeks later. But so... That excerpt from the book got put in Huffington Post a few weeks ago, and the Washington journalists were giving me trouble about it and said, we don't believe it. So I actually tweeted the pictures, play by play, them showing me how to do it, me doing this, and then me hugging my daughters after the fact. So if you want to see live action shots, you can go to my Twitter feed to see me shotgunning the beer to celebrate the fact that Todd Akin was my opponent, and it turned out our strategy, while bold and unconventional, was very effective because I won the race by a larger margin than anybody in statewide office has won in Missouri in a long, long time. So,
Senator, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Dick. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.